Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.
You're listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe.
If you have any issues, problems, or concerns, they seem to kind of just melt away when you're running. And things that seem to be a big issue, all of a sudden, when you're just putting one foot in front of the other, those big issues somehow disappear and become really small things. And I've always said that I make my best decisions out on the trail. And I really believe that. I'm Michael Coppe, and I'm 74 years old. I used to teach at a college here in Duluth, Minnesota, but I'm since retired. But I'm, in a sense, not actually retired anymore because I now build high-end furniture. I have 3 employees, and we do that about 30 hours a week. So,
when he's not making furniture, Michael runs what are called ultramarathons, which are races that are longer than a standard marathon. Typical ultramarathons are between 30 and 100 miles long, but can be as long as 200 miles or even longer. Michael has run 9 ultramarathons of 200 miles or more, setting some impressive records along the way.
I mean, there's certainly many younger, faster runners, but for my age, I set my first FKT, which stands for fastest known time, on the Superior Hiking Trail. And that's a trail that's 310 miles long, and it's right here in Duluth. It starts at the Canadian border, and I'd started at the northern terminus, and it went down through very rugged country through Duluth and then all the way down to the Wisconsin border. And that record was previously held by a 26-year-old person. And when I did it 5 years ago, I was 69, and I broke his record by 28 hours.
Michael was an athletic kid. In high school, he was on the wrestling team before moving on to cross country and track, where he discovered that he loved to run. But how does someone go from being on the track team to running 300-mile races over several days? For Michael, it all began with a mysterious plaque that appeared in his junior year.
All of a sudden, there was a plaque in the trophy case that said 1,000 Mile Club, and there was only one name on it. And I asked my coach, what is this 1,000 Mile Club? And he says, well, when school gets out in the spring and when school starts again in the fall, between those times, you have to run 1,000 miles. And if you do, you get your name on this plaque. And so I did the math, and it turned out that I had to run 13 miles every day all through the summer. If I missed a day, then it meant the next day I had to run a marathon. And I thought, well, I'm going to try this. And so that was kind of the beginning of my long-distance running. You know, a couple days I did miss, and so I had to run a marathon the next day. So that taught me not to miss too many days.
At the end of the summer, that plaque in the trophy case had one more name on it.
I'm the second person on that plaque. I haven't been back to see if how many are on there, but yeah, I'm the second, got the second name on there.
Running 1,000 miles in a summer is pretty impressive. But what Michael did was actually more improbable than you might expect.
So when I was 2 years old, and of course this was 1952 when polio was a real thing, my mother died from polio and I had an older brother that also died from polio. And so most of our family got it. I got it and it was in my legs. And so from 2 to 3 years old, I had to wear for about a year a brace on one leg. And typically when people did that, they walked with a limp for the rest of their life. And definitely were not runners, especially not long distance runners. But somehow I got out of it and it did not affect me. I didn't have a limp and I love the long distance stuff.
Michael's love of running has many facets, beginning with the fact that it changed the entire course of his life. Back in the 1950s, when his mom died, it was unusual for a single dad to take care of a family alone. Michael remembers Child Protective Services wanting to take both he and one of his older brothers and put them in an orphanage or foster care. His dad didn't want that, so he'd find people to watch them during the day while he worked. But that had its own set of challenges.
About every 8 months or sometimes a year, we would have to move because Child Services would find out that my dad was taking care of us and they didn't think, you know, that he could. And so they would try to come and get us. And we would have to quick move to a new school, a new location.
Because of all the moving, Michael never spent more than a year at anyone's school up through seventh grade. As soon as he'd make some friends, they'd have to move again. All of this took a toll.
And because of that, I ran with a pretty rough crowd. Most of my friends, I remember, especially in junior high and early senior high, ended up in jail for some reason.
That could have been Michael's path, except that the shape of his world began to change as he embraced running.
Running, for me, has been such an important part of my life, and I certainly not ended up here if it wouldn't have been for running. When I started going out for cross country and track, one of my best friends on the cross country team, he ended up being the valedictorian of our class. And this is the largest high school in the state. And so I got to see a different lifestyle than what I was living. And that really changed things for me. So running really was the key for me to change my lifestyle and sort of change the crowd that I hung with. But then, you know, running itself, I just loved. And so, you know, there's so many aspects of it, just the meditative part of it, the way that if you have any issues, problems, or concerns, they seem to kind of just melt away when you're running. You have one job, and that is to put one foot in front of the other and keep moving. And, you know, everything else just disappears.
Michael has found that that meditative aspect of running, the thing that's often called flow, tends to be proportional to the distance traveled.
I love that feeling. That's one thing that attracts me to doing these races. And I find the longer races lend themselves much more to that than shorter races that are more intense.
Of course, intensity is relative. The shorter races focus more on speed, and the longer ones are more about endurance. And there are a lot of factors that go into being able to run a 200 or 300 mile race over the course of multiple days and multiple nights. But there's one factor that is absolutely foundational.
One of my strong suits is that I'm very good at sleep deprivation, which is something you really need when you do long events because you have to try to go as long as you can without sleeping, which, you know, brings in a lot of unique things that happen, especially at night. And I've found that I can tolerate a lot less sleep than most people. I only need a couple hours sleep, and I feel pretty revived.
Even with this ability to function on very little sleep, the long ultramarathons that Michael runs bring him to the edge of his limits.
You know, we're talking 3, 4, or 5 days where you're running really 23 hours a day and maybe getting an hour of sleep per day. And in the beginning, that's very doable. But when the third day rolls around, your mental acuteness is greatly diminished. And you're still able to keep the legs moving and still able to keep going down the trail. In fact, you can get to a point where you can actually be sleeping while you're running. I mean, that's not good because if there's a turn in the trail, you're not going to make the turn. But I have actually fallen asleep standing up running, and it's hard for people to envision that, but your body will just keep doing the same motion, and yet your eyes and your brain and everything sort of turns off and falls asleep. You don't stay asleep very long because it doesn't take much to jolt you back out of that.
Even when the eyes and the brain don't fall asleep, other strange things tend to happen while running through the darkness, with only a headlamp to keep you tethered to your surroundings.
When you do these long events, the nighttime is like a different race. And especially after 2 or 3 days, when the mental fatigue sets in, running at night, all night long, through the dark wilderness, and almost all these races that I'm doing they're in wilderness areas, so they're quite wild, but it is totally a different event than when day comes. It almost feels like two different races, because at night, when you're tired after 2 or 3 days of running straight, you know, you see things that you know are not there because they don't belong there, but yet you see them, and they're as real as if, you know, they're right in front of you right now. And you'd swear that you just passed a person playing a grand piano or a grizzly bear standing off to the side, and you get there and it's just a rock or it's a broken down tree or something, and it's, you know, it's of course never those things that you, and it's not hallucinations. This is just being at night because you're sleep deprived and just looking into that darkness, and all you have is a headlight that shines maybe 30, 40 feet ahead of you, and you see these figures, and, you know, and you can tell yourself it's not real, but boy, your eyes see it, and your brain thinks it's real, and you know, once you get there, you can see it's not real, but it sure feels real at the time. Even if you're not hallucinating, I don't know what it is about the night, but there's something about the night that just brings this out. Now, real hallucinations, that's another level.
Indeed, when Michael raced the Superior hiking trail for one of his fastest known times, on the fourth of 5 nights, he was seeing much more than the occasional piano player or grizzly bear.
I found after 4 and 5 nights, you got to start sleeping 2 hours or 2.5 hours per night because it's just not enough. And so I was running with a person. We had about an 8-mile stretch between 2 road crossings where I would see my crew again. And this was, you know, in the middle of the night. I think we left at probably 11 o'clock at night, and we weren't going to see our crew again until 3 o'clock in the morning. And we're running through this stretch. You know, I was feeling fatigued and tired, but I started noticing that things did not look like the woods that I was in. Rocks started looking like hubcaps. And it was real dry during this time when I was doing this. And the earth had a lot of cracks in the earth. And those cracks started looking like I was running on a metal grate. And the trees, that I remember ferns, looked like pallets. And all these kind of weird shapes. I was in the middle of a woods. And everything was natural, but everything that I looked at was man-made from my eyes' perspective. And I told the person that I was running with, I said, you know, this is really getting weird. And it was just getting more and more profound. And, you know, at first it was just a couple things. Pretty soon it was more and more until the whole woods turned into man-made items, you know. And I knew in my mind, I mean, I remember as I was running, telling myself, this isn't real. But it didn't matter. My eyes saw what they were seeing. And, you know, and so normally when we would get about a mile away from where we were going to meet our crew, I would have my pacer, my running partner, run ahead and tell the crew that I was coming so they could be ready, have food ready for me and whatever, and tell them what I needed. But I told her, stay with me right to the end because I don't know where this is going. And, you know, I don't know what I could do.
Michael's caution was based on experience. While running the Tahoe 200-mile race, he and his pacer were running up the trail and saw someone's headlamp light shining up into the trees and side to side. When they reached the runner, they asked what he was doing.
And he said, I'm lost. I don't know where my house is. And I said, well, what do you mean? I said, you're doing this Tahoe 200. You're in the race. And he says, what race? And he was so hallucinating and so out of it, he didn't know that he was in that race. He didn't know where he was. He was trying to find his house. And, you know, of course, he was probably hundreds of miles from his home. But we told him, well, just follow us. We'll bring you to the next aid station, and then you can sleep and, you know, get back together. And so he did, and we got him in there safe, and I don't know what happened after that.
Another time on a 240-mile race through Moab, all the racers wore tracking devices, and race officials could see that one runner had gone way off course. When they got to him, he had thrown his expensive poles over a cliff and said he was running from cell phones.
He only had like 15 miles to go before the race was over, and he ended up not finishing the race because cell phones were chasing him. And that was because of sleep deprivation and hallucination.
So long-distance running has not only been meditative, it's also been exciting and at times perilous. To up the ante, this past year, Michael decided to go for a record at the Arrowhead 135, which is known as one of the toughest ultras in the world. Racers can compete on foot or on skis or bicycles. Michael wanted to be the oldest runner to ever complete the race.
Okay, so the Arrowhead 135 is an event that starts in International Falls, Minnesota, up at the Canadian border. And International Falls is known as the icebox of the lower 48. In other words, it's supposed to be the coldest spot in the lower 48 states here. The race takes place on the last week of January, which is supposedly, statistically, the coldest week of the year. The runners, which is what I did, we all have to carry a lot of gear that is required by the race because we have to be able to survive out on this trail. Because many times, if something happens, we're not going to have anybody to help us for, it might be 8-10 hours before we'd see any help if we need something. And it could be 30 below, so you've got to be able to survive out there. So it ends up, all the gear that they require us to have is about 40 pounds. And so the runners typically pull a poke or a sled. My sled weighed about 50 pounds with everything in it. I have to have a minus 20 degree sleeping bag, a bivy to put the sleeping bag in, and a sleeping pad, a stove and fuel, changes of clothes. I have to carry all my food. There's only three checkpoints or three spots that we can get water during this whole 135-mile race. We can have no aid from the outside at all of any kind. And so once the gun goes off in International Falls, there's only three spots that we can stop to get water. And one of those spots, we can buy some food. But other than that, we're pretty much on our own. And we have to make it through the dead of winter. In my case, pulling a 50-pound sled through the snow. And of course, that time of year, most of it is in the dark because International Falls in the end of January, we're probably talking 15 hours of darkness in a 24-hour period. So mostly dark.
While some runners say that ultramarathons are less stressful than marathons because they're not as focused on speed, the mindset that's required to complete and survive a 135-mile race in the dead of winter sets those runners apart from mere marathoners.
Yeah, if there's one thing about an ultra saying that we have is whatever is happening, it's going to change. And that means if you're having a really good day, it's going to change into a bad day. And if you're having a bad day, it's going to change into a good day. So you kind of keep that in mind that no matter what state that you're in at the moment, treat it as the moment. You try to really stay in the moment because if you start looking too far ahead, I mean, even looking at, okay, today I'm going to run 250 miles, for anybody, that's daunting. That's like inconceivable. It's not even possible. So you never look at the big picture. You always look at it as the moment. Okay, I just need to get from this checkpoint to that checkpoint. So you try to stay in the here and now, and that's really important. And if you are in a bad place, you know, it's okay. Don't ignore it. Don't try to push it out because you can't. Go ahead and acknowledge it. You know, my foot hurts so bad, I can hardly walk. Well, okay, sure, it hurts bad. And you can talk to yourself about it and say how much it hurts. But give it 5 minutes and that's it. Then say, okay, that's all the attention I'm going to give you. And you've had your 5 minutes. Now it's time for us to get back to doing this race. One thing is you do have to be able to tolerate being in a discomfortable state almost continuously. It's always one thing over another. Well, that foot really hurt, but now something else hurts so much more, like your back from pulling the sled.
Despite being one of the shorter ultras that Michael has run, the Arrowhead Ultra is actually one of the more grueling races.
This event is probably one of the toughest, if not the toughest event that I've ever done. There's a lot of aspects about it. You know, one being the cold and being out in the elements, but then putting yourself in 15 hours of darkness every day and out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we are so isolated. There is no cell service. There is no contact with the outside world. Most of the time, you are all out in the woods by yourself, going through spruce and tamarack swamps and pine forests.
One of the more serious challenges is managing body temperature in freezing conditions while going up and down hills pulling a sled.
The last thing you want is to get sweaty and then get wet, because then you're going to get cold. You're right on that edge. It's an uncomfortable edge to be at, but you can't be too warm that you're comfortable, but you want to be cold enough that you're not generating sweat. And so you always got to be opening up with zippers or taking off a layer. And then when you start going through really hilly sections, now when you go up a hill, you generate a lot more heat. And of course, if you go up a hill, you're going to probably go down the hill. And in our case, we get to hop on our sled and go fast down these hills. Well, when we do that, that cold wind blows over you. And so you've got to be able to regulate all that stuff, because you can be in a pretty miserable place pretty fast.
The Arrowhead Ultra is limited to around 200 participants. And whereas many of the ultras have lotteries to enter, the Arrowhead has an application process, including submitting a race resume of sorts and a letter explaining why you think you can finish the event and survive the harsh conditions along the way.
There was a couple stretches where I was by myself for 8 hours and never saw anybody. Sometimes you wonder, am I on the right course? And the course is hardly marked at all. Maybe every 5 miles, you'll see one of these signs that says you are on the State Arrowhead Trail. So it's kind of a little disconcerting that you're out there for hours on end without knowing if you're really in the right spot. And, you know, what would you do if you weren't? Because there's nobody going to come out there and help you. You got to be able to survive on your own.
The Arrowhead Ultra begins with fireworks. Then the bikes get to start the race, followed by the skiers, and then the runners. All of the racers are required to wear blinky lights on their bodies and sleds, just in case a snowmobile comes around a corner.
We all take off in the dark, and it's kind of a scene in the beginning to see all these blinky lights off in the distance, but we get spread out pretty fast. Doesn't take long before most of the time you're all by yourself. The first section of the race, you know, from the start to the first checkpoint is 37 miles, and that's pretty flat. And so the main thing that you have to deal with there is boredom. Most of that is through spruce swamps and tamarack trees. Then we get to the first checkpoint, and that's a store, and there's, of course, a lot of activity there going on, people taking care of whatever they have to take care of in terms of clothes and eating and talking to each other, and you get in and try to get out as fast as you can and get back on the trail. And then it's night when you get to that first checkpoint, typically. So then you know the next pole is 35 miles to the next checkpoint, which is Mel George. And that's going to be in the dark the whole time. That's at night.
Mel George is a little over halfway into the race. When he arrived there, Michael got some food, changed his socks, and embarked upon the hardest section of the race.
The next section is 46 miles before you're going to see another aid station. So that's a long time. And this is the hilliest section of the whole course. And we're talking big hills. We're talking hills that you're climbing straight up for over a half a mile. And you know this section now is going to take me 15 hours to do this 46 miles.
Michael traversed this section during the second night, by which point he'd gotten a little bit of sleep.
I did sleep three times. I took what's called a snow nap for 15 minutes. I would lay down, put my head on the sled, the rest of my body was in the snow, and I napped for 15 minutes. Now, you couldn't nap any longer than that because you got cold, because you weren't moving, and I found out real quickly the best place to nap is at the bottom of a steep hill. Because when you woke up, you were shivering, and that's what woke you up. You didn't wake up because you had enough sleep. You woke up because you were cold. And so I would get up, and then I would be able to warm up really fast pulling up the steep hill. And because the last thing you want to do is take a nap at the top of a hill, get on top of your sled, and have a cold run all the way down the bottom. So that was something I learned fast.
While pulling a sled up a snowy hill sounds hard and monotonous, it isn't without its thrills.
I really look forward to sledding down the hills because it breaks up the monotony of just pulling and pulling and pulling. Going down these hills, I mean, that was the nice thing about this section. Even though it was 46 miles long, there were about at least a dozen big, big hills that we had to climb. And of course, it meant if we climbed them, we also had to go down them. And we would hop on our sleds. Now, this was at night, and all we have is a headlight on, which only shines maybe 30 feet at the most ahead. And so you're going down this hill. You're on a trail that's about 10 foot wide. And on each side of you is conifer trees. And so they're just black at night. And so you see this ribbon of white going down this hill. It feels like you're in a tunnel and you can't see that far ahead. And you're going at 30 to 40 miles an hour, sitting on this little sled, using your heels to make you turn right or left to maneuver, because most of these hills are not straight down. They curve. And you hope that a deer or a moose does not decide to run across the trail at that time, because there's no way you could stop with your heels. It would take you a half a block to slow that sled down. I'll give you a couple examples. I had one hill that I was going down. This was at mile 99. There was an old lean-to there. This hill, I went down, and at the bottom of the hill, they had a bridge. And these bridges typically go over a creek or something, and they'll have a ramp going up to the top of the bridge, about a 45-degree ramp, maybe 5 feet long, and then the same kind of ramp on the other side going down. And then, of course, you have the bridge connecting the two. And this bridge was about 10 feet long. At the bottom of this hill, I hit that bridge so fast, I cleared the whole 10 feet with my sled and didn't come down to the ground until I hit the ramp on the other side. And so that's how fast we were going.
This was the second night, so Michael was pretty fatigued at this point. And remember the visual anomalies he talked about?
This is when you start seeing things. So I saw things all night long that second night. You know, rocks and trees were not rocks and trees anymore. They were all kinds of things. And the problem is, especially when you're going down a hill, you think, geez, here comes a moose, you know, and you want to turn or something, well, that would send you right into the woods. So you have to let those kind of, I wouldn't say they're really hallucinations, but just the figment of your imagination when you're that tired. You have to know that that's what it really is and just ignore it and just say, yes, I trust that this white trail that I'm following is safe for me to be flying down this trail at 35 miles an hour.
At 5 a.m., still in the dark, Michael stopped briefly at the last aid station and had a cup of hot chocolate. That turned out to be a pivotal moment, because Michael also took a few caffeine pills to help power him through the last miles. He thought each pill was 100 milligrams, but he later found out that they were 200 milligrams.
So I had 600 milligrams of caffeine in me, and I never drink coffee. So I'm not used to caffeine. And shortly after that aid station, they call it the biggest hill on the whole course, and the name of the hill is called Wake 'Em Up. And it does wake you up. It is so steep. Of course, we had to climb it first, but then we got to slide down the other side. And it's the last hill in the course. It's about a little over 20 miles after that hill, and then it's flat all the way to the finish. It's just a big spruce and tamarack bog. Perfectly flat. You can see for probably 10 miles ahead down the trail. And now the sun is coming up for the third time, and I am high on caffeine, and I've never experienced this before. My legs, I could not control them. Typically in a race like this, you kind of get around certain people that are going somewhat your same pace. So you see them at a checkpoint and then you pass them or they pass you or something happens and they have to stop or you have to stop. So you're sort of, we call it leapfrogging back and forth. So you know kind of who you're going to be around and who you're going to see for most of the race. And I was going so fast because of being high in caffeine, I was literally sprinting this last 20 miles, but I could not slow my legs down. And I got 3 hours ahead of the people that I was typically around. And it was such a weird feeling that my lower body just would not slow down. I would tell myself, you got lots of time to finish this. You don't have to rush. And I was able to slow myself down for the moment, but then as soon as I quit thinking about it, the next thing I was sprinting again and pulling this sled, you know, this 50-pound sled.
That last morning was cold, so while much of the race had been on what they call mashed potato snow, now the snow was finally firm, making it easy to run without slipping. And it felt good.
And I kept passing people, and there was no reason for me to be doing this. You know, I didn't need to go this fast. I had a lot of time left. But 10 miles to go, I'm on this nice, firm trail, and I'm flying.
As Michael was flying along, a county groomer came through to even out the trail for snowmobiles.
And turns the whole trail back into mashed potato snow. And of course, he's waving and smiling and thinks that he's doing us a favor because he's making this rough trail now perfectly smooth with the groomer. And so now we're back to where we're slipping with every step and your sled just doesn't move as fast now. It's more resistance. And so it was just hard pulling. And so I pulled my sled for another 4 miles. And then all of a sudden, I just collapsed to the ground. And I couldn't get up. And I put my head on my sled and was just laying there. And after, I don't know how long I laid there, maybe 15, 20 minutes, another racer came by and asked if he could help. And I said, no, I said, I think I'm done.
Michael was only 6 miles from the finish line.
And I called the medics and said, I'm done, you know, I got to get pulled in. And so two medics were coming with snowmobiles.
The racer who had stopped to help offered to pull Michael's sled for him so he could walk to the finish without the extra 50 pounds. The medics arrived and confirmed that that would be legal.
So I walked 3 steps and one of them was on each side of me and after 3 steps, I went right down and they held on to me and we tried it. We walked about 30 feet every time, 3-4 steps, and I would fall right to the ground. So I just told them, I said, yeah, I don't think this is going to be my day here. I just can't go on. My whole core, because of sprinting for almost 20 miles, pulling that 50-pound sled, had just totally fatigued itself. And it couldn't do any more, and it just you know, it wasn't even a mental thing. It was just physical, pure physical. My muscles just wouldn't support themselves anymore. And so I told him, I can't even walk in. And I had, you know, 6.3 miles to go. I had 7 hours. So I had to do was walk a mile an hour, and I could have finished in the cutoff time, but I couldn't do it. So I ended up dropping there at mile 129, and that was the sort of the end of my race there.
No one over 70 years old has ever finished the Arrowhead Ultra. Michael was 74.
I would have been the oldest person ever to finish. When I told the medic, you know, that I'm done and, you know, it's just not my day, he said, and it's kind of hard for me to say this stuff. I get kind of choked up about it when I think about it. But he said, in my book, you already set a record and you are one tough MF. And he said, there's no shame in calling it a day now.
Aside from the personal accomplishment of completing the race, Michael knew that others were invested in him finishing, and he was also raising money for the local YMCA. There was a lot of hope and expectation.
There was a lot of people at the finish line, you know, cheering for me and wanting me to finish it. Of course, I wanted to, but I made some bad mistakes, rookie mistakes, I guess you would call them. And I should have known better. I mean, I trained for this for basically, you could almost say for years, because I've been training for so long. And I went out and did some really tough things prior to the race, put myself in some really cold conditions to make sure I knew what I was in for and everything. And, you know, I really thought I could do it. And of, you know, the 9 previous 200 plus races I've done, I've never dropped out of one of those. And it's hard when you put that much effort not to be able to finish it, you know. And I know, you know, my crew and my supporters were all rooting for me. And so I know people feel that, you know, I certainly gave it 110%, and, you know, they all feel like I did a great job, but you kind of feel, no matter what, that you kind of let yourself and other people down by not getting to the finish line. But next year, I'll change that.
You heard right. Next year, at 75 years old, Michael plans to try again.
You know, we all have sort of dreams and aspirations. And I think as you get older, we tend to sort of say, well, it's time to let go of those and forget about them. But I don't think so. As a human being, I think we need to follow our dreams and aspirations as long as we can do that. Don't give up on those dreams, even when you get older. So as long as I can keep running, I'm gonna be running.
You've been listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe. Nocturne is produced by me and was created by myself and Kent Sparling, who also composed the theme music. Find out more about Nocturne at our website, nocturnepodcast.org. I'll post a link for Michael Coppi there in the show notes for this episode. Thank you to everyone who supports Nocturne on Patreon and PayPal. Extra big thanks to Timothy Peters and Karen Jesse for joining our Happy Possum level on Patreon, which is our highest level of support. Find out how you can help Nocturne at nocturnepodcast.org/support. Listener support is our only support. No more ads means it's up to you to keep the show going. Again, that's nocturnepodcast.org/support. Nocturne is a proud member of Hub and Spoke Audio Collective, Find out more about all the fantastic shows in Hub and Spoke at hubspokeaudio.org. Till next time, be well, and thanks for listening.